and standing by right now is our new technology commentator. And today it's Steve McCabe. A very good morning to you.
Good morning, Catherine.
Microsoft buys Skype. How big is Skype, by the way? Whether it is the full kind of face, you know, computer-to-computer face thing or using the phone system, how big has Skype got?
Well, they're saying at the moment they've got in the order of 330 million active users per month, which is, I beg your pardon, I'm trying to get the wrong number there, about 124 million. 124 million active users every month. That's a decent number of people.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's not...
Oh, it's not trivial, no.
Yeah. And growing, one presumes, as well.
One will presume, yes. I mean, Skype have become one of those companies, they're a bit like Google, really, where they are perceived as being the main player in the market that they have kind of created. You know, people actually talk about Skyping other people. You know,
true. What is it, really? What's the generic?
Well, the generic would be Voice Over Internet Protocol, or I guess you could pronounce it as VoIP.
And this is why Skype kind of works.
Just a little bit better, yes.
Yeah. Okay. And so they, as an independent company, developed the Voice Over Internet, whatever it is, and now Microsoft wants to buy them.
Well, no, not really. I'm going to have to correct you there, I'm afraid. The whole protocol they're using, VoIP, is fairly standard. Lots of companies are using it. I mean, Microsoft themselves have their own VoIP network. It's called Windows Live Messenger. That is the one with the 330 million users.
Ah.
Now, what Skype have done, what they did, they founded back about 03, I think it was. What they did was they presented a very nicely established, easy-to-use system where if I've got Skype on my computer, you've got Skype on yours, then we can make free calls backwards and forwards from computer to computer. They then added the video aspect to it, so we can do video chat backwards and forwards, and they just managed to get ubiquity that way.
Can't you Skype to a telephone as well? I'm sure I've had people ring me on Skype.
Yes, you can. And this is how I keep in touch with my parents and my family back in England. The one thing that Skype have done, and I think this is probably what's made them attractive to Microsoft, is that they've actually got a tie-in with actual landline and also mobile telephony companies in a number of countries, most countries around the world. So that, and this again is where their profit comes from, you can pay a certain amount of money each month and you can have the ability to, instead of doing Skype to Skype calls to other computers, you can actually dial a number and make a telephone ring.
Okay, and the benefit of that is, of course, it's a lot cheaper than normal...
Substantially cheaper, yes.
...toll calls. So what is happening with Microsoft? Is it trying to take out a competitor or as we've seen in similar moves, perhaps trying to utilise its service under its own umbrella?
It's very, very difficult to say what they're planning to do. They've spent, first of all, it's worth noting, they've spent an absolute bucket full of money on a company that's making a loss at the moment. They've spent $8,000 million to buy Skype, which is a substantial sum of money for a company that's got debts of about nearly $700 million. So we're trying to figure out what on earth motivated them to do this. One suggestion that's being made is that they're going to try and integrate Skype's user base and Skype's technology, and also, as we mentioned earlier, their tie-in with telephony companies around the world, integrate that into the Windows Phone platform, which would then mean that you've got a system that can seamlessly switch between a cell phone call and an internet-based call. They could get a very, very deep tie-in, and none of the other major smartphone players have that at the moment.
Okay. So the sale has happened? It's about to happen?
Apparently it's gone through, yes. It's been finalised.
And what ultimately the payoff then for Microsoft?
Well, as I say, the payoff, presumably, we're thinking, first of all, it could be that they're bringing the user base over, but even though, you know, their 124 million users a month is a decent amount, you know, it's not necessarily that much. If you look at, like, the complete number of signed-up users on Skype, Microsoft have paid somewhere in the order of $1,000 a customer to get them over, which seems like an awful lot of money.
And obviously has the potential to backfire as a business move?
Well, quite possibly, yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that this has backfired on people. I mean, there's two things to look at here. First of all, Skype have been bought before. They were bought by eBay several years ago. They were bought by eBay for $3,000 million. And eBay kept hold of them for a while. You know, eBay also bought PayPal and did very, very well with it because that dovetails nicely with eBay's business model. Skype seemed not to, and they promptly divested themselves of their majority stake a couple of years ago for about $2,000 million. So people are basically buying Skype going, nah, maybe not, and getting rid of it. And it's quite likely that Microsoft will end up doing the same thing. We don't know yet. The other issue is that you've suddenly got two companies who, although they're very, very widely used, they're not widely loved companies.
They don't have the same kind of cool thing going on.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, yeah, first of all, nobody sort of lines up outside shops to buy the latest Microsoft product the way they do, say, with Apple's kit. They don't have that sort of trendy cool going on. But at a much more hardcore level than that, we've talked in the past about how Microsoft famously refused to conform to standards. They do things the way they want to do. They write their programs the way they think they should be written, and to hell with established standards and protocols, Internet Explorer being a wonderful example of that. Microsoft Word, for example, plenty of people use it. Very few people use it because they want to. It's, in my opinion, got a ferociously atrocious user interface. But it's everywhere, so we kind of have to use it. So you've got one company whose products are not universally loved buying another company whose main product, the Skype software, is in software development circles notorious for being very, very opaque. I've heard it described as basically being written as though it were a virus. It's got a lot of the characteristics of malware, in that it's very, very difficult to see why it's doing what it's doing. The way it's written, it's almost designed to keep out people who want to open it up and see how it works. So you've got a disliked company and a distrusted company suddenly working hand in hand. In some ways, it's a match made in heaven. In others, it's made in hell.
And the other suggestion is this about trying to keep it out of other competitors, therefore?
Well, there is obviously the cynical perspective as well, yes. If Microsoft have bought it, it means that, say, Google or Facebook or Apple, the other three main players in this context, can't get hold of it. And maybe for Microsoft, there's merit simply in that.
What does it mean for users, if anything?
We don't know yet. As I've said, the danger is, of course, that Microsoft could get their hands on it and take what is currently, on the front end, a perfectly serviceable and functional product, and Microsoftize it, and in my opinion, at least, that would make it an ugly thing to have to work with.
How difficult is it to use at the moment, for those of us who haven't got there yet? What are you doing to use it, either the visual function or the audio function? You're downloading what off the internet?
Well, you go to the Skype website, you download a program, and sign up for an account. That's the very, very basic level of doing it. If you then have the username of a friend who you can talk to, you can make a connection with them, and then that's it. Basically, you click an icon on your computer, you can talk backwards and forwards.
So it's not like there's a phone book you look up. You have to establish your own phone book of people you can contact.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
There are people who'll do random cold calling through Skype, but obviously that's kind of frowned upon. Generally speaking, you need to know the phone number of another Skype user in order to be able to take advantage of it. But once it's established, it's very, very convenient.
And if you want to do the whole visual thing, you buy that little camera thingy from somewhere, do you?
Well, these days, most computers are coming with it built in. And I would suggest that possibly companies like Skype have driven the integration of webcams into computers. They're probably one of the reasons why so many computers come with them out of the box these days.
On the idea of big companies owning various other bits and pieces, what has happened with Google and Buzz?
Well, it's funny that Google recently released Google Plus, their new social network that was going to take over from Facebook. And everyone was very, very polite and didn't bother mentioning the fact that, yeah, they'd done this before and it had failed miserably. About, when would it be? Last year, I think it was. Google actually came out with a product called Google Buzz. And first of all, slightly snappier name than Google Plus, but still, they were trying to have their own social network. Facebook had got this enormous market that they pretty much created. Google had to have one, and it didn't really go anywhere. And the biggest problem of all with it wasn't so much the lack of uptake. It was getting users. The big problem was privacy issues.
Again, and what in this case?
Well, I mean, this is obviously, if you're going to compete with Facebook, you have to do what Facebook do. And obviously, Facebook gets a lot of criticism for privacy problems. Google, again, were doing the same thing, that they were making what should be your private information very readily accessible. You were being required, as it were, to expose yourself in ways that you might not necessarily choose to.
So to use the old cliché, it couldn't possibly have done evil, could it?
Well, there's the thing. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the great things about Google. You know, they famously announced that their motto is, don't be evil. And obviously they're talking to other people, not themselves.
So the way it's been sold to the public then, if it's not doing evil, how have they sold it?
Well, they didn't. That's the entire problem. Basically, as soon as it came out, people started realising, hang on, this isn't right. So it was February of last year it came out, and almost immediately people were saying, you know, this is wrong. You're taking my information, and without my consent, without me even necessarily realising it, you're kind of exposing me on the internet. I don't want this.
Why doesn't this happen to Facebook?
That's a very good question. People have criticised Facebook, but I think one of the big things is with Facebook, you have to actively sign up for it. You have to put in your information. You have to go through the steps of, you're kind of aware that you've done it. With Google, I think what must have happened is the Google Buzz system integrated very quickly with the Gmail mail system that Google use. And I think what was happening was people were using Gmail already. They got comfortable with Gmail. Suddenly they used Buzz as an add-on. And next thing you know, everything that they thought they'd put in securely suddenly wasn't.
This is where, didn't Google say something ages ago about how they sort of road tested it on their own staff, and their rule of thumb was if our own staff are okay with it, then everyone will be.
Well, that there is that way of looking at it, but you have to figure that there's a certain self-selection going on with whatever qualifies as a Google staff person is not necessarily you or me.
The privacy issues were more than just publicity. There was actually some action taken.
Well, yes, indeed. In the United States, there are actually federal privacy protection laws, which it was decided Google had fallen afoul of. And in the end, this is, you know, one of the ways that American jurisprudence works. Individuals who were violated or who felt injured or hard done to didn't get a whole lot, but Google ended up forking over $8.5 million. They probably found that down the back of a corporate sofa somewhere, mind. But they set up a fund that was designed to provide education on the web about privacy, and you know, I don't quite know what good that will do, other than the fact that the trial lawyers involved in this are now demanding about a quarter of that settlement to pay their trial fees.
So how is the whole beating Facebook at its own game going, do we think?
Well, people are still on Facebook.
Google has been getting plenty of criticism on a few fronts lately.
Well, oddly enough, from within, actually. One of the most bizarre things that's come out of all this, in particular with reference to Google Plus, the supposedly non-evil successor to Buzz. There's a chap called Steve, I believe his name is pronounced Yegi, Y-E-G-G-E, so we'll go with Yegi.
Oh, is this his wonderful rant on the internet?
This is the one, yeah.
I've got it. I downloaded it. It was such a wonderful rant.
He's brilliant, isn't he? I mean, this is a guy who's quite high up within Google's engineering division. Apparently, he's a very, very highly regarded programmer. And he on his own personal blog, posted about a 5,000-word rant against Google, having no vision, no personality, no plans for the future. And what was the language he used? It was a pathetic afterthought with Google Plus. And to say that about your own company's product is basically sinking your teeth deeply into the hand that feeds you.
I don't know that he intended it to end up, but should have known better, and perhaps did, that it would end up being read by millions.
A man who works for Google should always know better than to think that, if it's about my private blog, nobody will read it. The moment it goes on the internet, first of all, Google servers will find out about it. I can't believe how naive he was.
What is interesting about it is that it's kind of insightful because of its length and depth into the runnings of a company like this.
Yes, absolutely. But I think what's also very significant is the fact that he, as soon as he realised what he'd done, he set up an appointment with Google's PR people, HR people, I beg your pardon, their human resources people, fully expecting to be at the very least chastised. And apparently they were perfectly cool with it. They were saying, well, you know, we have to be open to criticism, which I think is a fantastically broad-minded attitude from a company.
And perhaps he'd written them a blueprint for areas to improve.
Well, quite possibly, yes.
Another important figure in new media has died.
Yeah, this is sad on a couple of levels. I mean, first of all, obviously the world has lost a very significant figure, but it also shows us how our priorities are a little bit skewed. About a week or so ago, we lost a fellow named Dennis Ritchie. And I'm guessing that while most listeners will have at least heard the name Steve Jobs, whose death was quite widely publicised, Dennis Ritchie's name won't be quite as big, which is a shame, because without Dennis Ritchie, there wouldn't have been a Steve Jobs in many ways.
Who was he? What did he do?
Well, he was a geek's geek, if you like. He was a computer scientist who was working at Bell Laboratories in the United States, which was basically a little computer science division of AT&T, which at the time was the monopoly player in the United States telephone market. And so he and a fellow named Ken Thompson were designing a new operating system called Multics, which was going to be this huge and ferociously complicated multi-user operating system back in the late 60s. And it was something that had never been developed before. It was just too big. But in the end, he suddenly said, you know what, we're going to do this ourselves. After funding's been pulled, we're going to work on it. And they wrote something called Unix instead. And Unix is...
Could you spell that for me, please?
UNIX.
Thank you.
There you go.
Just checking.
Well, it originally was actually, because Multics was actually spelled Multics. So Unix was UNICS. Very, very quickly, the CS got transferred to an X. And Unix was going to be a standard operating system, because you have to understand that at the time, every computer in the world basically was its own discrete entity, and there was no standardization. What Unix was going to give the world was going to be a way in which it can be reliably assumed that your computer and my computer have the same underpinnings. And so if you write software for yours and you write it for mine, it'll work on both. So that was a really big deal. And that in itself was nice. What was really important was that AT&T, because they were a monopoly, had terms and conditions of their monopoly agreement that said that they couldn't be in the computer business. And so as a result, Ritchie and Thompson basically gave away Unix. And they gifted it to the computer science departments, or that as a, some people have said, in fact, they created that discipline. They gifted this software to the universities of America with the condition that, first of all, they weren't going to be charged for it, and so they wouldn't be able to charge for it afterwards. And secondly, they could modify, tweak, develop it at will with the condition that it remained a non-profit system. And so it spread like wildfire. It's all over the place now. It went through a couple of developments. One of the big developments was when AT&T realized what they'd just been required to give away. They started to try and assert ownership over it, at which point people over in Berkeley University in California, University of California, Berkeley, they wrote their own version of it, which is now known as BSD Unix, the Berkeley Software Distribution. And the incredible thing is that BSD Unix, with a nice, pretty point-and-click user interface on it, is now sold on the shelves as something called Mac OS X. It's what Apple use for the operating system on their computers, and it's also the underpinnings and the kernel of the operating system that powers iPhones and iPod Touches.
So there you go, and it all began with him.
Absolutely. And like I say, he did this basically on a non-profit basis. He gifted this to universities. He didn't do this as a means of getting rich. He did it because, basically, he was interested.
Point taken. Good talking to you. Thank you. Steve McCabe, our new technology commentator. I should say there's a link to an article about Dennis Ritchie on our website, radionz.co.nz/9 to noon.